Well, good evening. I have been reading the Lanka some more. Maybe you have too. And thought I'd come back to the Alaya Vijnana and talk about that some more. And I even made a handout so that might, I hope, be helpful. I found some words of Koban, and that might help. And I realized that I made a mistake. That thank you. I said the Bhumis and these consciousnesses were the same list, and they're not. The Bhumis are a vipassana concept of the path of the bodhisattva. And so I've outlined them here. I took it from the insight. Thank you, Britt.
Thank you.
Took it from the encyclopedia of whatever that's called, Oriental religions or something like that. And this is not a complete list, but a kind of a sketch to give you an idea of it's supposed to be a progression of lands, different lands. A Bhumi means land or place, I guess. So you can see it's about getting better in practice, leading finally to another level of existence of transcendent bodhisattva. And from there, the bodhisattva does not fall back, is already just... and then there are several more that lands her in the land of Dharma clouds at the very top, where all the bodhisattvas gather around this now Buddha, who becomes the teacher. So we don't do Bhumis so much, even though I've heard them mentioned over and over. So I guess in Mahayana there's some aspect of this that is helpful for people. It's hard for me to think that it's such a cut and dried kind of process that it just goes from one thing to the next, but we always need some way of talking about what happens, and so sometimes it's helpful to lay out a plan, even though it's not exactly what happens. It gives us something to think about. But the eight aspects of consciousness are the... actually, there are ten. There are two more. But it's the Alaya Vijnana concept that comes up over and over in the Lankavatara Sutra. And it comes up because it's an explanation of how the mind works. And it's, of course, from our perspective, it's very, very simplistic. And yet, it has served very well for centuries as a way of explaining ourself as not being a fixed self, not being attached, that what happens to us is our five senses that are taking in all the information, the sounds and the smells and the tastes, by virtue of what we're able to experience, which is quite remarkable. And then that sparks our thinking. It sparks consciousness. We have something to be conscious of. As I said last week, even Helen Keller had something to be conscious of, the feeling of water on her hand. And from that, she could make a word. understand a word that her teacher spelled into her hand. It's really amazing. So that consciousness is just what we always talk about as thoughts coming and going and coming and going. It's just a streaming of thinking that's happening. Reactionary thinking, some of it based on the past, on our conditioning, and some of it based on what's happening now that we aren't even noticing. We'll get a certain smell that comes through the room, and suddenly we're flooded with thoughts of something far, far in the past that it reminds us of. So that's a constant. And from that, we have a mediator who is to hold the mind in uninterrupted flow. And then they call the mediator, the manas consciousness, as an interrupted flow. So it pulls out, starts pulling out those thoughts as they come by and says, oh, this is mine, or I want that, or ooh. It creates all kinds of judgments about what's happening and begins to make up a self out of this constant flow. And of course you can't use all of it, so you can be discriminating and show, oh, I want that one. That's really nice, you know. Makes me look good. And so it's a process, a constant process, and mostly unconscious. With Alyavijnana, which is the next one, so manas is between the mind and Alyavijnana. The store consciousness, this is what Koban describes it, a person grows from Alyavijnana like a tree. Usually it's dark, everything sleeps in it, but it can, without changing, become wisdom, can be used, worked as wisdom. So the quality of sentient beings and Buddhas is the same. Everyone is this tree. Everyone has her or his roots in this tree, in this depth of storehouse consciousness. What Thich Nhat Hanh calls the seeds, it's a collection of the seeds from far, far past. That we've inherited as human being and human consciousness. And if we're not awake, not paying attention and just going along with things, then manas just becomes the one who is always deciding what part of it we're going to see and what other parts we're not going to see. And it all remains very muddy and confused and dark. But if we allow the light of our practice to shine into that depth, then shining the light into it suddenly creates a place that is filled with possibility. Filled with creativity, filled with life, and possibility. So keeping it in the dark is our wish. We would rather, because it feels like there's too much junk in there and we don't want to know about it. So it's another way of describing our sitting and how, as we sit, we have to face whatever's in there, because it just comes up. And we're encouraged, instead of running away, which is our usual way, to actually face it and be honest and let our light shine it. And as we shine our light into the truth of things, it all becomes light. And it becomes Buddha's way. Or as they say, samsara and nirvana are the same. Or as Koban says here, that the quality of sentient beings and Buddhas is the same. It's the same Avyavaishnana. It's just some of us try to shine our light there, and others don't. And others, meaning most of us, most of the time, I think, are picking and choosing and judging and just running the manas part of it. And now and then we sit down and get quiet and begin to realize how deep and how wide and how truly full of light this storehouse that we call me is. So Coben said one more thing. He said, if thinking and measuring stop, then store consciousness turns to brightness, to wisdom. How you act, where you go, is the direction wisdom goes. What you're doing is compassion. So in this case, if your consciousness turns to brightness, to wisdom, then you don't have to try to be wise. The light is shining, so wherever you go is wisdom going with you. He also described manas, the ego part, with all the thoughts arising and passing, the mediator, as, what did he call it, an office boy, who, without the office boy, you wouldn't be able to reach for a cookie, he said. So, gotta have somebody there to make it possible to grab something. Otherwise, you would just let things be the way they are. So that's a helpful way of thinking about this, too. Are there questions? Jeffrey?
So getting back to the Lanka. So habit energy that he's talking about is that also including Avyavaishnana stuff? Are we talking habit energy is not only what I've been conditioned to in this life, but in previous lives? Is that what we're saying?
No, no.
So we're only talking about.
Well,
which I mean is fine and dandy with me.
Yes,
it's certainly been enough. But
I think some would say it's about all of the above, and others would say no, it's just about now.
What are you most comfortable with?
Well, I'm most comfortable with now.
Yeah.
I don't know about past lives, except as a tremendous energy from which we live. But that I myself lived back there, I can't conceive of that. It just doesn't add up. And it doesn't seem necessary to understand this life. So I also noticed that the people who have past lives usually have very fancy past lives. You know, they were really dramatic and they were kings and queens and all of those things. So. It doesn't add up. But in terms of how we were talking about Buddha's enlightenment, and one of the things he saw was all of his past lives, but he saw all the life of the animals growing through time, and what he really described was evolution. And in that sense, we carry all of that in us. No, and our fetus looks like a pig at one point in our development. You know, it's just all of it embedded in us from the earliest amoeba that wiggled in the hot sea. So in that sense, then, we carry all of it, and we're passing all of it on, either as a kind of curse or as wisdom and compassion. Now, depending on how willing we are to shine that light or be that light.
All of us have it. It's not the storehouse consciousness is. It's not like we all have the same storehouse consciousness. It's us. It's from my experiences and from my experience life, which also includes though like a collective unconsciousness mm-hmm. you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And then and the light itself. That's a. The metaphor that we use too for ending ignorance.
Yes, it's prajna. Yeah.
So as I've been reading the Lanka, I'm really feeling a strong connection to the Heart Sutra. As I read it, I see how these come together really well.
Mm-hmm.
Red Pine is such a delight to read. His sense of humor
mm-hmm.
At times. I mean, he quotes Pogo Possum.
Yes. Yes.
I met the enemy, and the enemy is me. That got it sped.
Yeah.
And it just really feels like something that, as I work with this sutra, you know, I can just experience my training just deepening as a result. And how I want to talk about it is how I'm sitting in my sitting practice. There seems to just be a how you apply these insights. I think when we sit is most important. And this whole idea of projection of mind is kind of allowing me to sit a little deeper, I think, is the word I'm looking for. When I was younger and I'd read these things, I could not understand how I could apply them to my sitting or how I could apply them truly to my everyday life. But those things seem to be finally loosening. And it's a document now that means a lot more. It's more intimate to me than it has been in the past. So.
Good, I'm glad. Yeah, it is kind of amusing in Red Pine's hands. It could be a lot more solemn if he had.
He could, but, I mean, for example, to give you some examples, is how he's comparing the translators.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really funny stuff what he was saying.
Yeah.
He's concerned with the syntax, and then he's talking about, like, there's these other sutras. One that could have 100,000 lines or something like that, you know. You could tell in which direction he wanted to go in, and especially when you read how he started this thing out a long time ago. He heard about it about 35 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and all these other sutras started getting in his, you know. He did the Heart Sutra, he did the Platform Sutra. And finally it was like, I guess I'm going to do this darn thing, you know. It's it wasn't his favorite due to the level of difficulty and the challenges the sutra had in terms of translating it. So that's the kind of humor I'm referring to.
Yes.
Very human.
Yes. Yes. And charming.
Yeah.
In his funny way.
Remembering when his publisher offered him some money.
Yes, he was broke. Right. He was broke. He needed the money.
He said, okay, I'll do it.
And look what we've got as a result. So then it goes into, I think we're on to page 69, is that right? Does anybody know?
I have my marker there.
Okay, good. So then we have the seven kinds of higher truths, and it's another one of those lists of things that, unless you're a scholar, you really don't have to memorize. But as far as higher truth is concerned, it's just about one thing, and that is remaining unattached to what's seen. Detachment. So, he says, other doctrines and schools make a mistake and they refer to projections and views as reality. And he says, none of it. You can't even be attached to the attachment of projections, because that's already an attachment. So it's the mind that is not hooked into its own story. Doesn't mean an empty mind or a blank mind. It just means a mind that's flexible and moving along with things and not getting stuck anywhere. So he says, the suffering that arises from projection ceases upon understanding the true nature of one's own perceptions. So that's basically the message of this whole sutra, that we create our suffering, which was Buddha's teaching also. He didn't call it projections, but it's and puts back into our laps our responsibility for our own suffering. Not the suffering of getting stubbed toes or appendicitis. It's not like that. It's the suffering that we feel as judgment on ourselves and confusion and jealousy and furiousness and all the emotions that sweep through us all the time. Those are the kinds of sufferings that we are attached to. We're, in a way, fond of them because they give us a feeling of our presence. And the more we can pick and choose, the more we feel like we have a real presence. Now, if I'm emphasizing that my favorite color is this and my favorite music is that and my idea about the other thing is the only really good idea in that realm, then I'm creating a very, very wonderful complicated picture of myself that's inevitably going to be painful because it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit with anything else. It's all made up. So then it gets into causation. Now, I always get mixed up when it comes to causation. I always think it's, what is cause and what is effect? Well, the effect is from the cause, but it was an effect from the... And I think, no, wait a minute. It's very confusing. So in section 7, he critiques the views of other schools who hold that the effect exists in the cause or does not exist in the cause. And then they're ridiculed by other teachers. And if the result does not exist in the cause, this would be like eating but never producing shit. But if the effort exists in the cause, this would be tantamount to shit being present in food. He says, this section mercifully ends with a transcendence of all views of causation. A man of my own heart. But as he goes on, he talks about seeing things devoid of self-existence as projections from the beginningless past and as not existing apart from one's own mind. And when the cause of such projections cease, then the Alaya Vijnana becomes free from projections of a body, its possessions, and the world around it. And from what speaks and what is spoken and from what sees and what's seen. And they accordingly see what grasps and what is grasped as no longer interacting in the realm of consciousness. And whatever the mind gives rise to is existing in a projection-free realm devoid of origination, duration, and cessation. It says, Bodhisattvas soon realize the identity of samsara and nirvana. Seeing nothing outside the mind, they accordingly proceed from one stage to the next in samadhis that are free from appearances. So then that's the bhumis that they're progressing in. So he doesn't encourage study. Transcending the mind, the will, and conceptual consciousness is more the effort. And he says, those who seek the body that accompanies a Tathagata, which is an interesting thing, to seek a body that accompanies a Tathagata should avoid the fabricated projections of origination, duration, and cessation regarding the skandhas, dhatus, ayatanas, consciousness, causation, or forms of practice. So those are all the dharmas viewed as causation. So just forget about that, he says, if you want to really connect with how your mind is working with projections. So he talks then about how consciousness works. as a fiction. He talks about visual awareness. There are four causes that result in the functioning of visual consciousness. Lack of awareness of what is grasped is a perception of one's own mind. Attachment to habit energy of erroneous fabrications of the beginningless past, the existence of consciousness, and the desire to see a multiplicity of forms. These are four causes that give rise to the waves of consciousness in the ever-rolling sea of repository consciousness of Alaya Vijnana. So that's an interesting image. If Alaya Vijnana, the way it's usually called, a storehouse consciousness, is really a rolling sea, then the waves of these causes are causing it to be stirred. And that visual form, consciousness, with its visual form, consciousness arises together with the minutest sensory objects. And so with it, external forms arise. So it all arises together. The sound of the bell, the hearing of the bell, the hearer, and the whole world around the bell is all one life form, you could say, all one happening, one event. And you can't separate them, except in our mind, and we can easily separate them in our mind and write it all out, blah, blah, blah. But if you experience the bell, you experience it as not you and not it, but the whole thing together is happening. As the wind of externality stirs the sea of the mind, its waves of consciousness never cease. Whether there's any difference or not among the characteristics of causes and effects is due to a deep attachment to what arises from karma. So people don't understand the nature of form and senses, how the senses function. So he said, you should know, Mahamati, the kinds of consciousness serve as this cause of conceptual consciousness. That's where our ideas come from. And as they function, they do not think that they are the cause of changes in appearances. What change as a result of attachment to projections are the perceptions of one's own mind. As every appearance changes and disappears, the different realms that are distinguished themselves change. So the rising of appearances is offers us the opportunity to project anything that we are carrying in us or not. And then the Bhagavan repeated the meaning in verse about the waves in a boundless sea, blown by a powerful wind, breakers in a black expanse, they never for a moment cease. And he recommends that those who dwell among the mountains and forests, practicing there, watching the projections flow from their own minds, the Buddhas will notice that, and they'll attain masteries and psychic faculties, etc., and transcend birth and death. So that's why practitioners should draw near to Buddhas and spiritual friends. practicing is how we get out of the stuck place, which, of course, we know. So as the ocean and its waves cannot be divided, the mind and the forms of consciousness cannot be separated. Kind of strange to think of, really. All we know is what our mind is offering to us as sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. And what we're making out of it. Making and making and making. This goes on for quite a long time. Objective realms are never perfect, and karma keeps arising, while consciousness is conscious. Likewise, the will just wills. So while consciousness is spinning out its tails, the whole thing continues as a sort of surging ocean. Oh, it's 8 o'clock.
What stage are you?
78, 79. So I leave this to you all for the next 3 weeks with my blessing. It's a challenge, but a very interesting challenge to really look deeply into it. I appreciate what you said, Jeffrey. That was helpful.